All right, here we are. Welcome back now for the replay of Dan Steffen's interview from Tuesday, focused on his outlook, mostly equity-wise, 2026 energy stocks. Hey, everyone. Welcome to the KE Report in a daily editorial. Tuesday, December 23rd, creeping up here on Christmas. We are chatting with Dan Steffens. Dan is the president of the Energy Prospectus Group. Dan, I've received a lot of questions. Really heading into the new year, people focused on the stock front for oil and natural gas. And a lot of our followers, I think, know that at the Energy Prospectus Group, you have a number of different portfolios that follow everyone from the big stocks down to the little stocks, and also segregated between growth and dividend plays. We're going to get your outlook for next year, 2026, and some of the companies that stand out to you in all of your portfolios, plus address a few more of the questions that I have received. Before we do, though, time to give a little quick recap to the oil and natural gas markets. I want to start off with the oil markets, because oil continues to be under somewhat pressure. We're trading in the mid to high 50s right now. Outside of a run-up in June through about three quarters of June, the oil price hasn't really done much and has been arguably just in a downtrend all year. So, Dan, quick recap on the oil market, how it's positioned at the end of 2025.
Well, you know, IEA and has been forecasting that the global oil market is going to be grossly oversupplied, you know, and they've been saying it literally for 6 or 8 months. I mean, this is the most talked about oil glut in the history of humanity. I mean, it's incredible. Personally, I think a couple things are going to happen. Number one is U.S. oil production is probably going to go on decline in the first quarter, partly because of weather, but also we're just not completing enough wells. I saw a report that, you know, active rig count's down, the number of completion crews is down. And if you're not completing enough wells, you know, you got constant decline on the existing wells. And so I'm really going to do my forecast for next year. I just decided yesterday I'll start out, and when I break out a amount by quarter, I'm going to use 55 for the first quarter. But then I think I'm going to 60, 65, and 70 by the end of the year, maybe. I kind of do that in the forecast models just to show people how much impact it has on their operating income and cash flow. But if oil WTI averages 62.50, it'll be a very good year for our companies that we follow. And because they've really got their cost under control, they're drilling and completing wells for less CapEx, getting better wells, and that's been holding on. Now, natural gas, it's all related to weather. You know, we had a spike to like 550 in the U.S. when we had a big draw from storage in that cold week about 10 days ago, and now it's warmed up. So we're back below four, but all my forecasts for the fourth quarter were based on U.S. gas price of 350, and it looks like it's going to be more like 375, 380 for the quarter. So higher natural gas prices are going to offset the lower oil prices that I've used in my models. And most of the companies are going to report financial results about the same as what they had in the third quarter, I think.
Well, Dan, just to follow up on the natural gas price, you know, if we back up the clock a couple of years and you look, you really bottomed back in 2024, and it was down around 170, you know, 160, something like that. And maybe got it down to 150, but it's been on a gradual trajectory higher, even though it's very volatile, I'd say ever since then. So over the last year and a half, almost 2 years, nat gas has been in fits and starts moving higher. Do you anticipate that continuing the year to come? Are we going to get back to the point where we see $6-7 gas?
Yeah, I don't know if you'll say $6-7, because in the U.S., if gas gets over $5, then you know the utilities that can switch back to coal, then coal becomes competitive with natural gas. And in fact, we're going to have to keep some of our coal plants that were supposed to be retired in Texas. They're going to have to keep them open because there's no way that we can meet electricity demand next summer if they start shutting down these coal-fired power plants. But anyway, to answer your question, yes, I do think there's been a structural change in the natural gas market. Number one is we have a significant increase in LNG export capacity in the U.S. I just saw this morning it's like 4 BCF a day, higher than it was a year ago. And then we're adding another almost 3 BCF per day of additional export capacity. And these aren't things just, you know, facilities that are just being talked about. They're almost done. They're almost completed. And these are multi-billion dollar projects. So, and they've got commitments to deliver the gas. So, our export capacity by 2032 is going to be double what it is today, you know, in the like the 35 BCF per day market. And then we're going to get, you know, closer to global gas prices, which today we're looking at $9, $10 gas in Asia and Europe. And we've just gotten, because we have so much natural gas resources in the US and Canada, you know, they can add production, but the thing's going to be infrastructure. We can't build the pipelines, processing, gathering, processing and storage facilities fast enough. So you're going to have, you know, the LNG exporters are going to be in competition, bidding wars for natural gas supply with the utility companies that supply the gas to your house or business. And so I do think we should see, I expect gas to get into a trading range, maybe in the 350 to 450. Actually, I was just looking at EIA's natural gas forecast, and they are projecting that now, fourth quarter 2026, the gas price is going to be $4.30. And that's because they see the same thing that I see and all the analysts see, that it's going to be, if we just have a normal winter in the first quarter and the LNG exports go to where we think they're going to go, literally record exports month after month after month, it's going to be very difficult to refill storage before the next winter arrives. And so that's why I think if we get to like September, August, September this summer, and storage is still below average, you're going to see, you could potentially see spikes in $9, $10 gas in the U.S. But those are almost always short-lived spikes.
All right, Dan, well, we'll be following up with you next year in terms of what these storage reports look like and where the price is going. But yeah, 2025 broadly has been just a general higher average price than the last few years. And we haven't really gotten a huge spike except at the end of the year. Let's get into those questions. Let's get into the stocks then. Starting off with large caps, what stands out to you in the large cap stocks for the energy sector heading into next year?
Well, on my Sweet 16, I think, you know, a couple of them have been involved in mergers, and the merger of Vital Energy into Crescent Energy just closed last week, on Monday of last week, on the 15th. Yeah, the 15th. And the stock sold off a little bit because oil was down that day. But Crescent Energy has a very good mix of production between natural gas, oil, and NGLs. And most of its gas comes from the South Texas Eagle Ford play, which has adequate pipeline capacity. They can get their gas down to the big Gulf Coast export facility. So I think that one's way underpriced. I'm valuing, my pro forma value post merger is $24 a share, and it's just trading in the like 8, 830, 850 range. I think it's a serious double. When you have big mergers like this, especially stock for stock ones, and you know how many assets are they going to sell? They've announced they're going to sell a bunch of non-core assets. So what's the real production going to be? What's the balance sheet going to look like? What's the year-end reserve report? And I think you don't get a lot of the Wall Street analysts really want to cover it until they've got, you know, an audited financials for the first quarter or something. But I think eventually this thing's going to look really good to everybody, especially if gas prices firm up. Of the biggies, Devon's up a little bit this year. It's a good combination of natural gas and oil too. I tell you, Diamondback and EOG, which are really big companies. I mean, EOG is like a $70 billion market cap company. It's down like 15% year to date. And it is in such better shape, and it produces a lot of gas, like 2.5 billion cubic feet a day of gas. So I think it's really underpriced. I'd say it's got 30-40% upside. It pays a decent dividend. Yeah, some of these, let me tell you, some of these that pay dividends on my, these are my Sweet 16. One of the stocks I really like is Northern Oil and Gas. It is a, what they call a non-op company. It does not operate any of its production. And it's pretty large. It's a 2.1 billion cubic or $1 billion market cap, which is slightly below their book value, which is insane because this company is very profitable and pays a nice dividend. In fact, its dividend yield is about 8%. And so it's a good dividend. It's sustainable. They got really good, strong cash flow. I don't see any problem with them continuing to pay their dividends. So the way I look at that is you're just buying them for the dividends. With, you know, if the oil price firms up at all, you're going to get a nicer premium. And they do have a lot of gas also. But there's some good coming. Now, Vintiv is, you know, one that should be familiar with the Canadian people. It was Encana, changed its name to Oventa. looks really good, pays a decent dividend too. Let's see, just 3.2%. Another one, EOG's dividend is 4%, which is pretty decent for a company of that size. And these are really growth companies, not really for dividends, but they're a nice combination of growth plus a decent dividend.
Well, Dan, you brought up growth there. I know that you have a whole portfolio that tracks the kind of mid-size and even small producers that are growing production. Any thoughts on some of the stocks that really stick out in that snack bracket?
Okay, one that really jumps out at me is Baytex. Baytex announced that they're going to sell all of their Texas assets. And the sales price, the sales proceeds are more than their total debt. So they say they're going to return some of this to shareholders. Now, I don't know if they're talking about stock buyback or whatever, but I think they may be paying a special dividend when this deal closes. And the balance sheet is going to be pristine when this thing closes, because literally the cash proceeds could pay off all of their debt. And then that's going to fund, because they say they want to accelerate the development of their Canadian assets that they have. And it's a pretty big company. I mean, it was 100,000 plus, 150,000 BOE per day of production. It pays a little dividend, but not, it's not really a dividend stock, but I think it's just grossly undervalued. Again, it was trading below book value, which is crazy. Last time we talked, I talked about Journey and Spartan Delta. Neither one of them pays a dividend, but they are in a joint venture up in the Duvernay shale oil play up in Western Canada, and they are reporting. Spartan Delta is the operator, and they have been reporting quarter after quarter of fantastic well results, and it's pulled back. But we're both trading at about double where they were. They were up close to 100%, both of them, before this little pullback, but they pulled back to a nice entry price. And actually, Journey, which is the smaller company, it's a 70-30 joint venture, whereas 70% is Spartan Delta, 30% Journey. But for Journey's size, it's a much smaller company, only 200 million market cap. For its size, this deal is very significant for them if they can keep reporting those kind of deals. Now, the one thing that Spartan Delta is, because its production is about 80% natural gas and NGLs, so it also has leverage to rising gas prices up there. So one for dividends in the small cap growth portfolio, which is not really for dividends, but the highest dividend yield is from Riley Exploration Permian. And that symbol is REPX. It pays about a 6% dividend yield. And they have also recently announced they're going to aggressively buy back their stock. And because they think it's grossly undervalued, and so do I. My current valuation is about double what the current share price is.
Dan, I want to follow up on these dividend stocks because look, a lot of these stocks do throw off dividends. I get that. But even your last example there, Riley Exploration Permian, 6%, there are some stocks out there that are paying double digit percentage wise. So, what just in dividend stocks? So, people are just looking for the income dividend aspect. Which ones are some of the highest payers out there that you like?
Yeah, we have a high yield income portfolio, and it's got 12 companies in it, and they're broken into three categories. So I got three minerals companies, and these are companies, they don't have any drilling risk because they actually own the minerals. So their revenue streams are what they call royalties or overriding royalties. And one I just published a profile on last week is Blackstone Minerals. It's a master limited partnership. I know some people don't like them, but it does pay really good dividends, and it is heavily weighted to natural gas. It's the most weighted to natural gas. Now, the one that pays the highest, has the highest dividend yield in the portfolio, is Kimbell Royalty Partners, and it's a split about 50-50 natural gas and oil. Its symbol is KRP, and at least for this year, now I don't know about next year, but for this year, their dividends are categorized as return of capital. And it is a partnership, but it has elected to be taxed as a C corp, and therefore it's not an MLP. You don't have to wait for a K-1. You just get 1099 at the end of the year. Now, the biggest one of the minerals companies is Viper, and it was created by Diamondback Energy that spun all their minerals off into Viper. Now, it is more heavily weighted to oil, and it's also almost 100% Permian Basin assets, but it's very big. I mean, this is going to be like 150 BOE, 150,000 barrel oil equivalent production per day company, which is much bigger than Blackstone Kimball. And but for growth, it's got the most growth upside, and the dividend is like 5 or 6%. Now, I have five upstream companies in the portfolio. They all happen to be in Canada, because Canadian companies do pay really good dividends. And the one that really jumps out at me right now is InPlay Oil. They hosted a luncheon for us in Houston a couple of weeks ago, and the CEO, Doug Bartoli, I know you've had him on your show a few times, he is super bullish on their new largest shareholder, which is the Delek Group, which now owns like 32-33% of the outstanding common stock. It's by far their largest shareholder. Delek Group has two seats on the board of InPlay. And the track record of Delek is, and they're a really multi-billion dollar fund. And when they invest in a company, they invest to build it up and potentially sell it. So I think this is a build up and sell story. It's now producing about 19,000 BOE per day. And split, but it's going to get some benefit from rising AECO gas prices, though, because about 30% of its production is gas. The number one, I would say, for natural gas and dividends in Canada is Peyto Exploration and Development. They have an outstanding marketing group. Of all the companies I follow in Canada, their natural gas prices realized are very big, like double some of the other companies, because they're selling a lot of their gas under NYMEX contracts, not under AECO contracts, and they're able to get their gas across the border to U.S. buyers. Surge Energy's in there. I think it was kind of, more heavily weighted to oil, but the stock is trading at about a 50% discount to what I think is fair value. The biggest one is Whitecap Resources. I picked up coverage on them when they acquired Veren, and they got a great deal on Veren, by the way. And they really have a lot of running room, but it's much bigger than these other companies. Now, I like Hemisphere. Hemisphere had a little bit of disappointing information for us when they said that their Marsden polymer flood has yet to show any response to the polymers. And Hemisphere is a pure play on oil. It does have a pristine balance sheet, literally no interest-bearing debt, and it pays a real good dividend, about a 7 or 8% dividend yield. Now, the safest places to put your money probably in the energy sector is the midstream companies, because unless we have a major recession, these companies get paid for moving, you know, through their pipelines, through their gathering systems, processing plants, storage facilities. That's what they get paid for. So they don't really have any commodity price risk or drilling risk. And all of them that are in the portfolio, it's Antero Midstream, Enbridge, the largest by far, One Oak, and Plains All American. I expect all of them to increase their dividends. In fact, Enbridge, One Oak, and Plains have all told me that they're going to increase their dividends next year. Of those four, the best dividend yield is Plains All American Pipeline. There's two ways to invest in it. It trades as, it's an MLP, Plains All American Pipeline is, and it trades as PAA, but you can buy the general partner, which is taxed as a C Corp. And it does, so you don't have to wait on K-1. It pays us the identical dividend, but because its share price is a buck or two higher, its yield is a little bit less. So if you're okay with owning MLPs, PAA is the better investment for dividends. But PAGP is pays identical dividends, and both of them, PAGP is like 8%, and PAA is 9+% dividend yield. So very strong, and PAA is trading below book value. No midstream company should ever trade below book value. If they're profitable, they should never be trading below book value.
Well, Dan, there's a lot to loop into there, but one of the questions I want to ask you about is the balance between a company paying dividends, buying back shares, or investing in growth. And they can invest in growth two different ways. They can invest in growth organically within their own portfolio and drill more wells and you know, get more things going, or they can invest in acquisition. Some of those companies you brought up, like Whitecap or InPlay Oil or Viper, all grew all three ways. They grew through paying a dividend to shareholders, returning money that way, but growing their overall portfolio of assets and also growing through acquisition. What kind of a balance do you like to see? Is there any preference that retail investors want versus institutions? Any color around that?
Yeah, they're all these 12 that are in here right now have got growth potential. And frankly, I tell you this, and I'm doing this personally, almost all of my money in my energy portfolio is all invested in stocks that pay dividend because they're just, when you get those dividend checks every month or every quarter, that just keeps building it up, even if the stock prices don't do much. And my number one criteria is sustainability of the current dividend. Number two is potential to increase the dividends, which I see. And almost all of these, I do see the potential for them to increase, especially the midstream companies and the ones that are a little bit more heavily weighted to gas. But number three, and I'm very much into running room. I call it running room. Do they have growth potential? And Whitecap has a ton of growth potential. Surge does too. Surge, I looked at, I we published a profile on it just the other day. If any of your listeners, want to send me an email or something, I'll send you our profile on these companies because I just updated them all recently. But Surge just in the last few days, and I think they could really have. They've got an area they call Hope Valley. And they're drilling these multilaterals. They drill down, straight down, and then they're putting multi, they're doing 12 laterals per well. So, just think down at the bottom of that hole, you got holes going out in all different directions, and it's exposing them to really, more and more of the zone. And they're reporting results that are way above the type curves, which a type curve is what the independent reserve analysts give for their estimate of what these wells are going to produce. So when they report results above the type curve, that means they're better than they were expected, better than the economics they expected to get when they drilled the well. And that Hope Valley area is getting, type curves are getting production like 50 or 60% above the type curve. So they look really good. And they've got, dozens of more development drilling locations there. They got another area where they're doing multilaterals when they get to the bottom. I think it's called Sparky, and it looks good too. So, but they all have growth, and I'm very firmly want companies that have growth potential.
Dan, how about mineral rights companies or royalty companies in this space? We deal in the metal space and usually royalty companies, which is a little difference between mineral rights and actual royalties, but same idea here. Companies that essentially get money because people are producing on their land, or at least they have a right to some of those revenues. Do you like any of these companies?
Oh yeah, that's what Blackstone, Kimbrel, Royalty Partners, and Viper. They're all minerals companies. And mineral, I say minerals, it's minerals and royalties. I mean, their payments are called royalties, but they own the mineral rights. And overriding royalty is a royalty carved out of the working interest. And the risk with an overriding royalty is if the lease expires, that royalty is going to also expire. But mineral rights are perpetual rights. They never expire, but they also have great value. They can be sold, anytime you want. It's just like real estate. You can sell it. So I really like those. Now there's a Canadian one that I'm going to add in a future newsletter here, Freehold Royalties, which is based in Canada. And I think its symbol is FRU. And it has a 7.2% dividend yield, and it's based in Canada. But these other three, my three are all US companies, Blackstone, Kimball, and Viper.
Well, Dan, do you segment by risk inside of your portfolios? Because something that's a dividend-paying stock like a minerals royalty company is pretty safe because they're basically cashing a check for other producers to operate. Like you say, they're not taking that individual risk, but they don't maybe have as much growth as, like, say, a small or medium cap, but it has more risk. So do you diversify your portfolio by the risk of a growth stock versus a royalty minerals company versus a large dividend payer? Do you have that kind of a framework?
Yeah, well, the reason I like Viper, it would be my number one pick for growth, is because Diamondback is aggressively drilling on their acreage, the last on their mineral rights. So the last time I looked, Diamondback was running 16 drilling rigs on Viper Minerals. And so every time they complete one of those wells, then Viper's production goes up and up and up, and it's got unbelievable growth. And in fact, they're going to report a big increase in their production from the third quarter to the fourth quarter because Diamondback dropped down a bunch of minerals into them the middle of the quarter. So, the middle of the third quarter. So they're going to have a big jump in their production at the end of, for the fourth quarter heading to the year end. They're going to have a tremendous reserve report at the end of the year too.
Dan, let's talk M&A then, because we chat with you every month and we're always talking M&A deals. It does, to me at least, seem like it has still been fairly active in the oil and natural gas world this year for M&A. Maybe we haven't seen the mega deals, but again, a lot of money, a lot of shares have been moving around. Any recap? What's your assessment of how active the sector was this year compared to years past?
Well, we didn't have the big mega deals like, you know, Exxon taking over Pioneer, one of the biggest deals ever. But, but the year before, we also had Permian Resources taking over Earthstone, which is a smaller company. But I love that deal because Earthstone was one of our small cap growth portfolio companies, and it was grossly undervalued. And they did a stock for stock deal with Permian Resources, and they just got a great deal on that acquisition. And Permian Resources is a screaming takeover target at this price. And I did that. I did this for 3 years. I worked on M&A with Hess, and we closed on, like, this is back when a billion really meant something. $3.5 billion worth of deals we closed on while I was with that group. And it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work to do it. But anyway, the one I really like, I mentioned Crescent Energy, Vital Gold, and, you know, for some reason, and maybe it was because it's based in Tulsa, I don't know why, but the Wall Street gang just did not like Vital. And I think the reason they didn't is because it was like Vital was, in another couple quarters, they're going to start paying dividends. Another couple quarters, then they would announce a big increase in their drilling program, or they would announce a big acquisition of something and put off, you know, and they just got tired of waiting for the dividends. And so they dumped on it, and it was grossly undervalued. But it is doing a stock for stock merger into SM Energy, and SM is trading below book value today, which is crazy. It's literally trading at 50% of book value. And we were talking before, you know, we got on here, book value is just take the audited balance sheet, take total assets minus total liabilities, and divide it by price per share. And the accounting requirements for these companies that are upstream companies, they have to make mark-to-market adjustments on their assets all the time. So really, any profitable upstream company, especially ones that are generating a lot of growth and free cash flow, they should never be trading below book value. That makes no sense. You know, why would any company that's profitable, pays dividends, trade below book value? It's crazy. So I really like them. And right now they make a lot of sense because you save a lot of expenses just having one company that has to be public and then two companies that have to pay the lawyers all the time and accountants. But you also, you know, can reduce the number of people working out in the field if the properties are close together, or you can, you know, reduce the back office staff and stuff like that. So they make a lot of sense that way.
Well, Dan, just pressing the envelope a little bit more on M&A, in addition to those synergies of, you know, consolidating the teams and consolidating some of the overhead G&A expenses, a lot of times they change the whole pro forma company has kind of a different feel afterwards. So we've just already talked about a lot of M&A. We just talked about the Crescent Vital. We talked about Whitecap. We talked about Viper taking over Sitio. InPlay made a big acquisition earlier in the year. But the pro forma company that emerges after that sometimes has a different feel. And sometimes, to your point, the analysts, maybe they didn't like one or two of the components in separate vehicles. But when they're combined, it kind of makes it more of a juggernaut. So, you know, what kind of an edge can retail investors get by looking at and maybe pouncing on some of these before the street wakes up to the new pro forma company?
Well, I will tell you that 90% of the time the stock goes down after they announce an acquisition, a big acquisition or a big merger. And the reason it is, I think that happens is because, let's say, I call them the Wall Street gang, but the Wall Street analysts, especially the generalist analysts, it is very difficult to build the pro forma forecast model. And they're kind of lazy. So they're going to wait until they get a fresh audited financials or a fresh reserve report or something before they really take a look at it. So the one thing, and I subscribe to the service called TipRanks Premium. And on there, they rate all the analysts, the energy sector analysts, from 1 star to 5 star. So these guys that are 5 star energy analysts, they follow all these companies already. So they know how to do a pro forma forecast. And like, you know, 1 or 2 days, they can add their two models together and do it. And I could do the same thing. And so what I do is I create a pro forma model. What's it going to look like, you know, the next year after this? And that's what I'm looking for, the ones where the Wall Street gang's really missing it, not doing the work it takes to really understand the value of the deal. And, you know, if it's an all-stock merger with the Crescent Vital merger and the SM Energy Civitas merger, they're all stock deals. So they're not really overpaying because there's no money. Now, they are, you know, assuming the debt of the acquired company. And typically how these are really structured, when they do the stock exchange and the acquired company just becomes a wholly owned subsidiary of the parent company, like Civitas will become the wholly owned subsidiary of SM Energy when the deal closes in March. And then it takes a while before you can transition all the assets into the parent company, if you want to do that. We usually would wait a couple of years before we did that at Hess.
All right, Dan, you know what? We'll wrap it up here. You've given us a lot of stocks to look into, a lot to really segregate too, depending on what you're looking for. I know some of these stocks kind of blend some of those categories, especially with the dividend aspect, but you've been sharing that with us all year, keeping us up to date on what you're seeing and some of the more macro reports. And then company news, that's what our audience seems to like the most of. And boy, oh boy, you are on top of so, so many of these stocks. For all of you listening, you want more information and to keep up to speed with all these stocks Dan's following, go to the Energy Perspectives Group. I'll post that link in the show notes. Going to look forward to chatting with you throughout 2026. So Dan, Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, Happy New Year, my friend.
Yeah, same thing to you guys.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.